So it's a great
pleasure and privilege to have a chance to talk to Paul Rabinow, who is going to give the Fraser Lecture this afternoon in Cambridge. Paul, I always start by asking where and when people are born, so that's the first question.
1944. I was actually born on an army base in Florida. My father was in the U.S. Army at the time, but I was raised in New York City. The end of the war. Apparently, my first word, my parents thought, had a southern accent. And since they detested the American South at that point, they sent my mother back to New York, and the rest of my youth and upbringing was in New York. So I'm definitely a New Yorker.
New Yorker.
By identification.
Right. The people liked, as anthropologists, we know how important our ancestry is. And people like to sometimes talk about, usually back to their grandparents, or earlier if you, sometimes mm-hmm. they go back to the Anglo-Saxons, but not usually. Did you know your grandparents? Or?
No, I didn't. I'm very definitely one of those cosmopolitan New York Jews, cut off and significant, 100% deeply identified as a non-religious Jew, but cut off as perhaps more Americans are from the past. My grandparents emigrated from the various parts of the Russian Empire and came to the States in actually 1890s or something of that, around that period. So in fact I didn't know them. I've heard some stories about them, but nothing in any great detail. So I know some of my parents' relatives. My father's family was in upstate New York and my mother's family was in New York City, but didn't have any deep historical connections, and simultaneously have felt no great desire to do the roots thing on the one hand. On the other hand, feel very settled about my identity in that sense. And this has come up.
Feel very settled or unsettled?
Settled.
Settled.
Never had too many questions around that. Although, as you've met my wife Marilyn, she's a Chinese American, we have one child, Mark, who's now at New York University, and so he's Californian, Chinese American, Jewish American, so some of this ancestral complexity comes up more with him than anything I've ever felt. So, and his maternal family and grandparents are in San Francisco, so he has actually more connection to the Chinese and Chinese American side than to the New York side, although he's now at the University in New York, so.
Melting pot, as they say.
Yes.
So let's move down to your parents. How did their occupations or interests affect you?
Yeah, very strongly. Both of my parents were psychoanalytically oriented social workers. My mother worked in various places, but basically was quite socially committed, although not very politically active in a direct way. And my father worked first for the Veterans Administration after the war, and then for an organization called the Jewish Child Care Association, which was again a sort of social welfare, homes for children, protective services, and the rest. So I had a very strong set of connections in intellectually, as it turned out later. One, I've never been interested in psychoanalysis, and not
nervous. Do you have an antipathy to it?
No, but I don't believe in it, and I've never, as a more rebellious adolescent, I thought that it didn't there was hypocrisy or what have you involved. In any case, it didn't seem the path forward. Mm. And the inward looking depth analysis has by itself never been my interest. My parents were also very strongly anti-communist, leftists, but very strongly anti-communist. So I grew up with sort of foundation myths of, on the one hand, in our neighborhood, Sunnyside in Queens, which was a garden city where Lewis Mumford lived.
Oh, yes.
And actually Hildred Gertz grew up there as well. Mm. It was a mix of socialists and communists, with the communists being actually somewhat more in the social class than the other variety of socialists. So the two founding experiences, one before my birth, was the Hitler-Stalin pact, in which the Daily Worker ceased publication, I'm told, for a week because they simply didn't know what the party line was about that. And my parents repeated this story to me any number of times about basically why they also didn't trust communists and the like. And the other experience was McCarthyism when I was quite a young man in the 1950s in New York, an atmosphere of fear, not personal fear, but a sort of general mood of fear. And then many of the, I'm told, communists moved out of the city as a protective move, and actually moved to the suburbs, and the wealthier suburbs, and became bourgeois to the hilt. So those are kind of, that's an essential part of my political formation, which I still adhere to. I've never been a Marxist, I've never been a communist, although I certainly consider myself in some unlocatable fashion on the left. And I suppose the other thing, which is that my parents were also simultaneously completely Jewish identified, not religious, I didn't have a bar mitzvah, and anti-Zionist. So a very mixed combination of strong standards and attachments, but not connected to big movements and the like. So maybe New York City is the core of that. And I've challenged many things in my life, but that still stands with me. I would characterize my opinions today as still largely in that vein.
Two things that occurred to me as you were talking. One is, if they were anti-communist, what was their view of the McCarthy trials? They might have had some sympathy with McCarthy or not.
No, absolutely not. This is, I think, one of the roots of, perhaps to a degree, why I became an anthropologist.
That's what we want.
Yeah. I was brought up that to believe very strongly that America was simultaneously probably the best place in the world to be for a Jew, but also not very trustworthy and not very safe. I was of America, but not fully American. And the experience in the South, when my father was in the army, of absolute blatant racism, which was, of course, everywhere in the United States at that point, but certainly in the South. And then he was an officer, and in Kansas, at one point, they lived off base, and in the house of a woman who was a very blatant anti-Semite, since there was no other place to live, they never broached it with her until they left. And she had never met a Jew, and that was, was the kind of what we're seeing so much of today, again, in America, strange hatreds based on not based on personal experience of any sort. So the sort of dépaysement, I think, which I was raised with and which I accepted, I think is certainly one of the strong roots of how I became and why I became an anthropologist and why I continue in many ways to identify with being an anthropologist, even if my anthropology is a bit unorthodox and in its own way. But I think personally and existentially that's the connection to me, that I'm a citizen of the world but don't totally really belong anywhere, you know, full fashion. I mean, frankly, the only places I feel at home are New York and Paris, even though I've lived in California for 30 years. I like California, but it's not the same rootedness. So,
I did an interview with Simon Schaffer, who described himself in much of the same way as you, though I think he did have a bar mitzvah, but he described himself as a totally secular Jew, mm-hmm. who accepted that Judaism was very important to him, but he didn't subscribe to any of the religious tenets. Mm-hmm. But he described himself also very interestingly as someone who was both a participant and very much an observer. In other words, he was always outside from his infancy. He'd realized he wasn't really one of the club.
Yes.
He was an outsider and an insider. He was perfectly at home and relaxed like you, but he always felt at any moment that he was watching from the outside things going on.
Yes. I agree with that, although in New York City, since there were so many Jews, and there were so many other kids in many ways like me, I didn't feel, like many of friends who grew up in other settings, that I was isolated. Mm-hmm. So I went to Stuyvesant High School, which is a public high school for science and math.
Hmm. What age was that?
In the late 50s.
And you were how old?
15, 16, 17.
Yeah.
And there was citywide competition for there are several, two of these in New York City, and it's still there, and many Nobel Prizes have come from Stuyvesant. At the time it was 90-some-odd% Jewish. Now it's Asian and Jewish and everything else. So I was always with and several of my friends from the neighborhood, and I still know that most of the people I grew up with, which is very unusual in America. So I had that context, and that was in Manhattan. So I lived in Queens, but I went to school from an early age on the subway, and therefore this urban experience and urban dimension was very strong. But I also completely agree that the core community sense in a more traditional mode was never something that I had.
And you have always felt a sort of an observer from the outside, or as you described it, a world citizen rather than...
Very much a cosmopolitan. And France, which again I'll mention a bit this afternoon, for reasons that I don't fully understand, I've always been, since I've been really quite young, attracted to Paris and France more generally. And it's formed a kind of alter part of my life. Mm-hmm. When I speak French and something changes, I'm very comfortable in it. And so that's also offered as a sort of second home, although I'm clearly an outsider there, and I've always felt that I was an American in Paris, which is, even though not very typically American in many ways, was an excellent place to be. So maybe I'd mention, during the Vietnam War, I certainly was not going to serve in the United States Army, and there was still deferments for people who were in university, and I was at the very edge of the time, and also I got my PhD when I was very young. So it was very touch and go, and I considered leaving the United States at that point, and because I was not, certainly wasn't going into the army, and civil disobedience and jail didn't appeal to me, and Canada didn't appeal to me. Mm. So I considered France on the one hand, or, strangely enough, Nouri Alman, made discrete inquiries with Leach.
Hmm.
I don't know whether any of this is not discreet or not.
It's very discreet. I mean, speak. Say.
So this doesn't bother me, but it should be.
No, not at all. Go on.
I'll leave that to you. In any case, the response was a quiet, well, if need be, we'll do something.
Hmm. This was an appointment here in Cambridge.
Not necessarily an appointment, but a refuge.
Yep.
In other words, if it came to it, that this is where I would have gone.
Hmm.
But it, fortunately, things, or unfortunately, I don't know, but life worked
from
out.
From our point of view, yes.
Yeah, and the final deferment came through, and I stayed in the States. So, that being said, my attachments have still continued to be to France, rather more than anywhere else.
Well, everything you say is so interesting that things spring out of it. Two things. One is, you say you're going to sort of meditate a bit about France this afternoon, but
mm-hmm.
In case you don't cover it
mm-hmm.
fully, I mean, what you must have thought a lot about why it is that you find France a second home.
Yes. It's a combination of philosophic, intellectual connections, which in the 1950s and 60s were very, very distinctive and strong, and without a comparable tradition, set of traditions either in the States or in England. Combination of people like Sartre and Merleau-Ponty, a form of thought which was existentially committed but very, very rich and complicated conceptually, and connected to political concerns and debates, as well as people like Jean Lacouture and some of the very high journalists for Le Monde, who had a view of the world that I found very compelling and very broad, and in connection that made places like Vietnam and Cambodia and Algeria and Morocco very real and present to me. And then a certain form of sociability and conversation and elegance in Paris, which I always felt comfortable with, and a sensual life, of course. But it wasn't coming from a repressed existence. I mean, New York is New York. But there was an added style, an added sort of unashamed intellectuality and talk and way of modes of relating to each other that I always felt comfortable with and still do today. I mean, 2 days ago in Paris, it's just wonderful. I mean, I just feel very, very comfortable with that. So this is part of this alienation, if you will. There's a very nice title by a book called Le Juif Imaginaire, which is by Alan Finkielkraut a long time ago, in which he said his generation had really the best of both worlds. They had all the privileges of people, of the imagery of the Second World War, and therefore some privileged status of some sort, but never had suffered 1 second. And I feel myself a bit in that situation as well. So Paris, and this is part of the anthropological connection too, that the connection to the larger colonial world, the connection to sort of global politics, the connection to literature, to cinema, was present unabashedly in France in a way that really wasn't in the United States. Beyond that, I'm sure there are other reasons, but I don't really know, except that I've always been comfortable there. And my French is very mixed, but as Bourdieu said to me once, Paul, you speak completely fluent French and you make thousands of mistakes. And I've never had any, this happened again 2 or 3 days ago. People understand my French because I know what's going on with them. Again, a very anthropological sort of dimension to thing. And people ask me for directions in Paris, which is always, I don't look French, I'm not French, and et cetera. So, but it's an important part of my life, for sure. And my we raised our son bilingual. There's a bilingual school in Berkeley. And then he went to a French school in Paris for a year and a half. And Marilyn speaks better French than I do. And so it's just an important part of my life. That being said, in the last 10 or 15 years or so, the intellectual dimension has been diminished, because I think that both the philosophic and scientific scenes in France are rather dismal these days, unfortunately. French molecular biology is just not at the competitive scale of what goes on in certainly in the States, but also in England. And they know it, and it's hard for them. And then philosophically, there's not much going on at all either. And I would say the same for anthropology. Not as a criticism of anthropology, I would be critical of philosophy, but in anthropology, it's just stayed rather traditional and still dominated by Levi-Strauss, and that's fine. It's just not what I do.
So. Presumably it led on, we'll come to Morocco later, but you must have had some connection with your interest in choosing to work in Morocco.
No. I went to Morocco because of Cliff.
Cliff, yes.
With Gertz, which I'll mention very briefly again this afternoon. I was actually originally interested in Buddhism and wanted to work in a Buddhist country, and had done a lot of work with Mircea Eliade in History of Religions, and then with Yalman. And at the time, and then again, as I'll mention, with Barney Cohen, and for a variety of reasons, various places that seemed possible to work with was a live Buddhist setting closed down politically for a while. And then along came Gertz and said, in his inimitable style, want to work in Morocco? Basically, I said, where's Morocco? And that was the connection. Of course, there was a political connection to Algeria and colonialism and what have you, but I didn't know really much about Morocco per se, although obviously that changed. So that the things dovetailed rather than causal, if I can put it that way.
When you mentioned Buddhism, linked to the other thing I was going to ask you, it always comes up in the interviews, which is your religious beliefs, because you started off saying that you were a fully secularized Jew, but since then, have your religious beliefs changed? Do you believe in God, for instance?
No, I don't. And there's some beautiful passages in Triste Tropique where Levi-Strauss talks about Buddhism, which is sort of relatively close to what I felt much more strongly as a younger person, and which has stayed with me, I'd say, in a quieter way all the way through. This question is interesting because in the last several years I've been working with a youngish, not that young, student who's just finished a degree in theology and is going to get a degree in anthropology, Gaiman Bennett, and he's a Christian and a very practicing and devoted Christian, and we get along remarkably well, and talking a great deal about ethics and science and what have you. But it's clear that the larger theist dimensions are radically disparate. I don't have any, and he does. And yet, this is, to me, again, a kind of interesting anthropological dimension where, ethically, this seems to not cause any problem. And I frequently related to people with strong religious beliefs, but that are quiet, if you know what I mean. So, for instance, Michel de Certeau was a Jesuit and had a number of Jesuit friends. And I think it's the fact that they care and that they're thoughtful and committed and concerned. And I don't have to share, again, anthropologically, I don't actually have to share other parts of their belief system while finding them humanly worthy of friendship, perhaps is one way to put it. So, again, I would say that was an anthropological dimension of my existence, if I can put it that way.
There's been a lot of discussion, I don't know whether it's quite as a case in American intellectual life in this country, caused or related and often fomented by Richard Dawkins, about the opposition between science and religion. Dawkins argues that science has disproved religion and we can't be religious. What are your feelings about that?
Yeah, I'm absolutely uninterested in that argument. I'm not a positivist. I think there's a big difference between this form of 19th century militant positivism basically what perhaps the simplest way to put it is a Weberian position in which science does not answer ultimate questions and can't answer ultimate questions. I don't think that's what science is. So when science becomes a religion, a worldview, a cosmology, then it parts company, it seems to me, with its deep critical functions. And so I'm not, whereas I'm not a believer or a theist, I'm also not a militant atheist. And I think that debate is leads into a range of different discursive and existential corners that I don't want to go to, and never felt the need to go to. The same at a philosophic level with people like Habermas or Charles Taylor, who somehow make the argument that unless we have sure foundations for our ethical life that we founder, flounder, which has always seemed to me counter-empirical and simply wrong. I think no one's ever proved the ultimate foundations of anything to everyone's satisfaction, and yet ethical life and decent human relations seem to me not all that common, but not impossible either. So I'm very much not looking for ultimate stopping points, as it were. And again, I think there's some anthropological dimension to that as well, or a certain respect for the complexity of different commitments, and again, a cosmopolitan enlightenment sense that we have to live with difference, and that basically can be a good thing. And that intolerance, which many scientific people, perhaps, I don't know Dawkins, but one sees that is not so admirable. And a certain arrogance and contempt for other people's way of life is not something I admire. Listen to James Watson and you will realize that Max Weber was right, that only, as he says, big children in editorial offices think that because you're brilliant in one thing, you have any deep insight into something else. So.
Let's go back to the chronology a bit. You, as a child, do you remember anything about your childhood, and particularly what you were interested in, and hobbies, and so on?
I was very passionately involved in sports like many other people. And strangely enough, though, hockey, roller hockey in New York. Mm. And again, this was a strange obsession because these were mainly Irish Catholics who played roller hockey. The Jews played basketball. And so I was the only Jew in the Catholic youth organization. And so that also meant I lived outside of the home a lot. One went to parks, cement parks, not beautiful parks. Mm. But this was also always very, and with mixed ethnic and religious and age, and that was always very important to me. And later on, I was a swimmer and a runner. So that was one dimension of life. And then fairly early on, interested in literature and found it mathematics easy when I was young, although eventually by high school I realized I was not actually any... I was in an honors math class at this high school and realized I was not any particularly great shakes at math compared to all these other young men. But curiosity, I liked the city, exploring the city. Is that the direction you're...
Yes, yes. I mean, when I'm interviewing biologists and scientists, there's often something, some hobby of theirs, like collecting eggs or butterflies or messing around with Meccano or gadgets, which basically, as you say, they grow up like that and they go on the rest of their lives. So it's sometimes there's a clue in something that in that first 5-10 years. But another thing...
I think also school was easy and boring. Mm-hmm. And therefore, there was always something outside of the institutions, and there were books in the house, and I read, and classical music has always been important to me.
Yes, I was going to ask about music.
Yeah, I couldn't live without Bach and other. It's an essential, absolutely essential part of my existence.
Just Bach, or...?
No, if I had to name the greatest person who ever lived sort of thing, it would certainly be Bach. But no, a whole range of music, but classical music, and including contemporary, some contemporary music. But this morning, for instance, I was listening to Rameau, and I find it deeply important and satisfying. There's some deep spiritual dimension to music, which is very important to me.
Do you think it inspires your work in any obvious way? Do you work to music, or do you listen to music and then write?
Again, I go back perhaps to Lévi-Strauss and Tristan Lopique, where he talks about wandering through Brazil or wherever it was, and Chopin, and on the one hand Wagner, on the other our tastes are rather different, but there's some sense that there is something that's not discursive that produces beauty and harmony. And I often do write with music. Now increasingly with the MP3 technology and what have you can carry around vast libraries of music. But I find it actually just spiritually, if that's the right word. I've been using that word lately because discovered somewhat different sense that Foucault has been able to give to it, sort of in the Roman sense more than anything else, that it's sort of permissible to use it again. But it's great solace, I would say, as a part of my life. Mm. Other arts are important to me as well, but music would be the...
The others are painting, architecture.
Architecture for sure. Mm. More than pain. So music and architecture mainly.
You've never played?
Dance also. Modern dance. My wife and I go to a good deal of dance. I was obliged to play the clarinet, and like photography, it's good to know that one is not gifted at certain things and to recognize one's limits. So no, I've never. I have no gifts, talents in that direction at all.
You said that school was easy and boring, but was that the case all through your schooling? Were there any particular teachers who inspired you?
High school. Again, this great joy of a public high school. One of the things that has happened in the United States in the last few decades is this big separation between the private schools and the public schools, which you've had longer here, with the general decline in the public school system in America. It's almost obligatory, but that wasn't the case then. And high school, which was an all-boys high school, which made life also easier. And I had many good teachers in high school, and I really enjoyed learning. And there was no stigma to just being smart and enjoying things and learning and exciting, including good literature teachers. So that was a great takeoff point for me. And then the University of Chicago was just a vast expansion of learning, which I'll mention briefly this afternoon as well. My mother, of course, wanted me to stay in New York, and I met some people from the University of Chicago, and I knew instantly that I had to go to the University of Chicago, and it was absolutely the right decision. So Stuyvesant High School and then Chicago were, again, I know they were deeply, deeply exciting and rewarding for me, but most people don't have that in any case. Many people don't have that. The joy of having encountered that from that form of learning. So I'm very grateful for both of those institutions.
Was there anyone at Stuyvesant who you particularly wanted to remember or affected you in any way? Sometimes there's one or two teachers who...
It was more a general mood. We had some old math teachers who, which was particularly in that context, I was not at the top of that game, but there was something, and we were told famous boys, one of you is going to solve Fermat's theorem. I'm sure of it, and that was, you know, that was considered the ultimate thing that human beings could do. It wasn't for me, but I did have some good literature teachers, but nobody spectacular individual. It was more a general sort of ambiance. At Chicago, there certainly were people.
Well, tell me about Chicago.
Well, again, I'll talk about this briefly this afternoon, but the fact that the Hutchins, so-called Hutchins College, that structured a curriculum, was sort of basically still in existence, was tremendously rewarding for me. And then Richard McKeon, who was a great Aristotle specialist, but also proverbially knew everything about everything, one of those kind of thinkers, and a great teacher too, a difficult and not very pleasant human being, but
So you're still alive?
No.
Okay.
I mentioned this briefly, in the book Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance, McKeon is the nasty figure, and he was a difficult person, but as opposed to the portrait there, it's, for me, it opened up vast horizons of learning and of...
Why were you doing Aristotle? I mean, what were you doing as a degree there?
The curriculum was a general curriculum. So, for instance, McKeon taught a series, Ideas and Methods, one term of the physical science is one term and the social science is one term of the humanities. So Aristotle provided sort of distinctions to start of the different arts and sciences that were relevant in different domains. The other thing I probably should mention is you could take exams when you entered Chicago, and I placed out of all of the sciences and math. So I took a little bit more math, but I never actually took science in college. So this sort of return to molecular biology, which happened late in life, in a way came out of the blue, but in another way, I've never been afraid of science, and I always liked science. So it was a kind of belated return to some of the roots. But McKeon, again, the philosophy was neither analytic philosophy nor continental philosophy. It was a strange mix of sort of classically based but very large perspective on all thinking, which was very enabling and in fact still is. So McKeon was certainly the major intellectual influence. On my life at that point, and in many ways still is.
How do you spell his name?
M-C-K-E-O-N.
Richard. What we call McKeon, yes. Yeah.
His son, Michael McKeon, is now quite a well-known historian of the novel. And there was another son, Peter, who died, unfortunately, very young, who was also an extremely brilliant young man. Loved Beethoven. But as with many of these things, McKeon was not a nice person. And hence it was not in some ways like Foucault, was not a warm, fuzzy, tutoring kind of relationship, which in many ways was very freeing, because it wasn't personal in that way. And if you could flourish with that, which I think in many ways I did, I mean, Foucault was the other great influence, and both of them were very complicated men, and I seem comfortable with that.
We'll probably will introduce Foucault at the time when he first entered your life, shall we? Which is a little later, perhaps. Was anyone else at Chicago? Were there any social scientists by that point, or not?
Yes. A number of people. Nouri Ahmed sort of took me under his wing, as he tends to do.
Mm-hmm. I've interviewed him as well in this room, so.
He's remarkably the same. I haven't seen him in the last few,
just the same.
few years. It's amazingly the same. Anyway, he was sort of one of the extremely avuncular and supportive. And between McKeon on the one hand, but then there was a social science world which included Gertz and Barney Cohen and others, but they were a little bit more distant, and I encountered them a little bit later on. But Yalman, quite early on, not only was, since I was also interested in structuralism at that point, was also generous with his time, and very encouraging, and I don't think I actually quote learned that much from Noor, but he was very supportive and helpful and kind in a way that sort of contributed to being invested in being connected to anthropology.
By the time you'd finished that undergraduate degree, had you decided what you were going to do, or what happened then?
Well, again, I had a very strange, unusual trajectory. And you'll hear again a little bit of this. The anthropology department in Chicago was, of course, a very distinguished place, which meant they didn't teach very much. I was interested in Indian civilization, and
McKim Marriott was there too,
McKim Marriott was there, actually. Milton Singer and Noor were perhaps more directly, and Barney with more directly the people. So I had that broad introduction. I took the basic courses, and then since they weren't offering any other courses, I nor allowed me or had them allow me to take the basic graduate sequence systems. And at the end of that, he said, and I agreed, why don't I take the exams? And they said, you can't take the exams, you're an undergraduate. but I said, but I took the course, why shouldn't I take the exams? So they said, because no one's ever done it. And I said, this is Chicago, like, you can't give me tradition as an answer. So I did, and I came out of it first. So I was finished with my doctoral exams as an undergraduate. And hence it made sense to go to graduate school in Chicago. And anthropology seemed to me to offer many intellectual depth, ways of staying out of the university as one's whole life, a bit of exoticism and challenge, and then a lot of smart people who I thought were doing exciting things. So I went to Paris for a year. The deal was I was the first undergraduate to be admitted to graduate school from Chicago. And we made a deal that if I went to Paris for a year, they would let me come to graduate school, but I had already basically finished graduate school. So I went to Paris and listened to Lévi-Strauss and Louis Dumont, and then went back to Chicago and was actually kind of tempted to be a physical anthropologist. And Clark Howell kindly sort of suggested that he didn't think I had the temperament and that I might never find a bone. And then Cliff said, do you want to go to Morocco? And off I went. But I maintained a strong connection to the college and McKeon and the world around that type of thinking throughout graduate school. Because, again, I've never been fully socialized in a way, which perhaps partially explains some of the things I've done.
That year in Paris, obviously, was the beginning of this second home. Many people will have read and heard about Lévi-Strauss and Dumont. What were they like? Did you get to know them at all, either then or later?
Yes. Lévi-Strauss was extremely fond of and kind to young Americans. And so his seminar, this is 1965, his seminar had 250 people in it.
Good grief.
It was, you know, very trendy, and he was extremely nasty to most of them. But there were three young Americans. He was very, very kind to us and allowed us to sit at the table and what have you. Several times he came through Chicago. So I talked to him, but he wasn't the kind of person that chatted with. Dumont was a much more complicated figure. At the same time, his seminar had four people in it, and he was very, very bitter.
What was he bitter about? Of the four people, or
yeah. Definitely, and that his thought and his
deep... He'd written Homo Heraclitus, had he, by then, or published it, perhaps not. It was 1967, actually, I think.
Yeah, he was certainly thinking about it. Mm. And the course was the Two Theories of Kinship course. So when I was a very young man, I went and said hello. He gave me a several-hour lecture on... basically on Homo Hierarchicus and why the Nazis and had motivated his thought and how what his problem was about trying to explain the West and a good deal about his life and what have you, and clearly very eager for students and connections. Unfortunately, the course. There were four people to start with. There were two Tamil specialists, a young Scotch kid and me, And by the third or fourth week, there was a lot of Tamil kinship terminology being just used, and we both disappeared, which Dumont got very, very grumpy about. Mm. And told David Schneider I was a horrible person, what yeah. have you. And then this got resolved several years later with, there's a wonderful event in New York City on Christmas Eve. There's a midnight Mozart concert at Carnegie Hall, and this was always part of my youth when snowing, and it was a beautiful night. But the seats are, you have to run in and get seats. So running in with my friends, and there's Dumont and his wife. And I said, Joyeux Noël, Monsieur Dumont. And he looks the other way, and his wife says, Man, Louis. So he gave up and we shook hands and sort of kind of reconciled it at that point. And I saw him again in Chicago a number of times. And I actually think his thought and his work is extremely important. And in some ways, actually more complicated and interesting and wider and broader than Levi-Strauss's. But humanly, he was a tough character. So I kind of stayed away. I also went to several philosophy lectures at the Collège de France, Jean-Hippolyte and on Hegel, and Jules Villemin on Kant. So there was a sort of French history of philosophy tradition as well, which played in later to some of the other work that I did.
When Clifford Geertz said, go to Morocco. Mm-hmm. Julie obeyed him. Tell me about that famous first moment of arriving in the field.
In the field.
or the antecedents as well, if you want.
Well, as you know, Cliff was a not a warm and cuddly and comfortable human being, and even less so, the 60s. And so the contact with him was minimal. It was intellectual, but not much else. And so he facilitated things. We had there was a young Moroccan who taught us some Arabic and what have you, but basically I was on my own. So I flew into Rabat, and my first experience in Morocco was astonishment at the fact that Rabat was this extraordinarily beautiful city, and basically a French Art Deco city, along with the Medina, but no one in the literature had ever talked about this before. So my first experience was sort of, wow. And then eventually I went back and did some work on French colonial planning and what have you. So there was that. And then the experience in Sefrou and then in Sidi Hassan in the countryside, I would say that the main thing was how difficult Arabic was, for start, and continued to be Arabic. I have to say recently that learning molecular biology is nothing compared to learning Arabic. And then it was a complicated, difficult place, Morocco. And it was a sort of testing experience in many ways. But I wouldn't say I was ever became deeply enamored or engaged with Morocco. And Cliff was in the city and pretty much absent. Hildred was always more accessible and helpful, but I didn't have a big connection there either. So Morocco was a kind of, I wanted to be an anthropologist, I wanted to do something like that. I did it, but I knew I didn't want to do that again, and that had I known, which is of course ridiculous, I should have gone to Fez and lived in Fez rather than in the countryside, and I think I would have had a much different experience there than the one I had. Whether that would have ultimately changed things, I don't know. But I don't know if that's the direction you're going.
Well, there are two questions out of that. One is, you wrote a book on reflections and fieldwork in Morocco. Mm-hmm. Why did you write that, and what was the sort of main conclusions out of the book?
I wrote that because, partially because Tristopique was there, and not that I was at that level of literary execution and style, but that was one of the reasons, or one of the vectors, which brought me into anthropology. And then the experience of fieldwork itself was troubling, confusing, and lonely, and I was trying to figure out, and I was interested in questions of what kind of knowledge is anthropological knowledge, and basically, so I was trying to figure out what it is I was learning, and how it was that anthropological knowledge was actually produced, because that seemed to be one of the important dimensions of what was going on. That being said, as I've mentioned in the new edition that came out a year or two ago, the real structure of the book is Hegel's Phenomenology of Spirit, and it was a kind of unfolding of knowledge in various stages. So of course people read it as a very personal book, which in many ways I guess it is, but its intent was absolutely not that at all. It was a kind of way of staying sane and trying to figure out what it is I had been going through, and did I want to continue to do this. I wrote it very quickly. And
how soon afterwards?
I wrote my thesis first, and then I wrote, then I wrote this. So it was a few years later.
When you say very quickly, how quickly do you write, or did you write that?
I wrote it in a month or so, it was rewritten and reworked on a bit. But also, Cliff hated it and. Told me it would ruin my career, and it was rejected by 6 presses.
That's a good sign.
And so I basically had given up. And then, again, as I mentioned briefly later, the Robert Bella basically saved my career and this book at the same time, and went to the University of California Press and said, publish this. And they did, and now it's 30 years later, it's still in print and the rest. But I wrote it for myself, as kind of, as I say, orientation and figuring out what was going on, and what was I doing, and did I want to continue to do this sort of thing. So some books are quick and some are not.
Yeah.
That was quick.
Just, we've only got 3 minutes to go, but on this particular tape, but a great friend and senior colleague of mine worked for many years, a bit in Morocco, that was Ernest Gelmer. Mm-hmm. Did you know Ernest?
Well, of course, I encountered Ernest. I didn't really know him, and the first book review I ever had was a full page in the TLS attacking my book, not reflections, but the symbolic domination, and called Saints and Their Descendants. And so I called Cliff, this is terrible, and Cliff and everyone else assured me it's the best thing that could have happened, and that Gelmer no doubt considered to me to be in his debt because he had attacked me publicly in an important place. And then he came to Berkeley a while later, and a number of years later. And of course, it's exactly true. He considered that I was in his debt, and I took him out to lunch, and we talked. And that was perfectly cordial, although then later he got very nasty again. So about writing culture and that range of things. Deeply, irrationally hostile, not particularly to me, but to the whole thing, as was Cliff. So I never really knew. I came to Cambridge once and he didn't come to my lecture and what have you.
What do you think of his Saints of the Atlas as a book?
I thought it was very British and more about British anthropology than about Morocco. Jacques Berck and some of the other French anthropologists who had worked in some of those regions in detail had somewhat different views of how the tribes worked and what have you. So I thought, like a lot of good anthropology, it was a demonstration of a certain analytic tradition rather than ultimately being about Morocco.
So, after you'd come back and nearly thrown your career into confusion by writing an honest book about your fieldwork, and your supervisor was washing his hands of you, more or less.
Definitely.
How did you proceed? I mean, did you get a postdoc, or did you get a position? Or?
I had a position in New York. This is 1971. There were seemingly many jobs around, and again, being poorly socialized, I never really paid terribly much attention to the forms, and I had written my thesis in New York. I didn't go back to Chicago. I wrote my thesis on St. Mark's Place, living about three houses down from Auden. And perhaps in rather different lifestyle and degree of comfort, but so I took a job at an experimental school in New York City as part of the City University without thinking about it very much. It was amusing for a while, and then I spent a year at the Institute for Advanced Study, which turned out to be in some ways quite a momentous year. I had very little to do with Cliff, but Robert Bellow was there that year. And although it was a very complicated and tragic year for him, first of all, Cliff proposed him for a professorship there, and the mathematicians and others turned it down, so it was very ugly and very unpleasant. And then also one of his daughters committed suicide, so it was, very, very fraught. But he was friendly, and eventually that turned out to be a very important avenue of development for me. But also Pierre Bourdieu was there that year, and particularly in the beginning, he didn't really speak English very well. And we spent an enormous amount of time together talking and getting to know each other, and he outlined in great detail how he was going to get into the Collège de France and the entire sociology of the French field in every possible dimension. And he did exactly what he said he was going to do, and it worked exactly how he said it was going to work. So that was kind of the next wave of French intellectual connection after Dumont and before Foucault. So, but very important in that what was going on in French sociology and social sciences and where he thought things were going and what have you. So that was very important. And then I went back to New York, and then the fiscal crisis of those days hit. And what had been an experimental school and fun stopped being very experimental and stopped being very fun. So Bella ran a seminar, for National Endowment of Humanities seminar in Berkeley, and he accepted me in, and that kind of was the turning point, which again I'll talk about briefly this afternoon, where he helped me get the book published, where I met Hubert Dreyfus, where a whole range of other connections opened up, and I discovered California, which then, and to a lesser degree, but still somewhat today, seems like an exotic and foreign land, with many joys and some other weirdness. So I think that, I know that was the next development, and that led into Dreyfus really was a great teacher, and his master, and I was totally obsessed with Heidegger, so I learned a great deal about Heidegger, and in a different way about Wittgenstein at that point, and that set the scene, as it were, for the entry of Foucault into the picture. I mean, that was the immediate preparation for what was going on. I got a job at Berkeley during those years. They wanted a Chicago anthropologist, so I was competing against several of my classmates, and things worked out. There are several lines to help me here. Either the anthropology department, which it's less to say about, or the Foucault-Dreyfus connection.
Well, we've started with Bourdieu, so let's pursue. What was Bourdieu like?
He was, unlike Dumont, he was a very, very overtly passionate and direct person. I mean, he was not a small-talking, casual guy. He was very strong and very deeply engaged with everything he did, including hatreds and competitions and opinions and what have you, which I rather liked. And but he also demanded a loyalty after a while, and that became a bit of an issue. But he, I often compare him to any number of French novels, but the Sentimental Education of Flaubert's really, or The Red and the Black in a different way, is really Bourdieu. Self-styled provincial, mythologized his marginality and his provinciality, comes to Paris because he works through his intelligence, fights his way to the top, increasingly powerful and influential and increasingly unhappy in many ways. An extremely intense and brilliant character, but one who really, truly wanted power and recognition in a way that I don't think I know anyone else who desired it as much and was overtly conscious of plotting and strategizing to achieve it. And having achieved it, there was always, of course, more. And then, again, like in so many of these French novels, convinced that when he reached all these summits and still wasn't happy or didn't feel fully everyone bowed down in awe when he walked down the hall, had got fairly paranoid about what the reasons for that. So increasingly in his latter years, when he got more and more militantly, stridently political, I saw him less didn't share his politics. And also his approach to intellectual life, which had been very different before then, but then it just increasingly became, he was right about everything. Dumont had some of that too, but Bourdieu wasn't just like a personality trait. He would argue at length about anything and why he was right and everyone else was wrong. And that was kind of boring.
Talking of these powerful personalities, you were going to tell me an Edmund Leach anecdote.
There was a Wenner-Gren conference in Fez, and we were in this extremely luxurious setting overlooking Fez, with the call to prayer periodically, and a beautiful day, and the mosques quite visible. And this was a conference in which there were very distinguished senior people, Leach, Goetz, songs in particular, and then a range of sort of younger people. And so the conference was sort of Gertz and Solomons fighting with each other. And by the second day, Leach turned his back to the table, and he was ill at this point with visible head lesions, and faced out this beautiful perspective over Fez, read the newspaper, and periodically swivel back in the chair and say, "It's rubbish, it's all rubbish," and then swivel back and look. No one knew what to do, so they basically ignored it. And then Sherry Ortner, as is her wont, tried to mediate this obviously impossible situation. And so what happened was she started to do that. So everyone turned on her. And so it was a difficult event. But the memory that sticks with me is Leach absolutely expressing his contempt for the whole thing.
I'll tell you afterwards a similar story. But well, let's move on then to your Wikipedia entry, which says that above all, you are famous for your close attention and scholarship on Foucault. So tell us that story.
Right. I had heard of Foucault, of course, before, but was never very interested in his work. And Dreyfus and Sir John Searle and I had talked a lot. And my first year at Berkeley, Searle and Dreyfus were giving a seminar on Wittgenstein, Heidegger, Foucault, and Derrida. And I was a participant in the seminar, and this was the time when Searle and Derrida were yelling at each other, and which didn't interest me very much. But Dreyfus and Searle interpreted Foucault as a structuralist, which I didn't care, but I didn't think was right. So we started talking about that, particularly Dreyfus and I. Although Searle and Foucault were always actually fairly good friends. And we decided to write an article together. I began to convince Bert that, at the very least, what he was saying had to be nuanced and made a little bit more complicated. And at that point, someone mentioned that Foucault was coming to Stanford. Or as my wife reminds me, it's correct English to say, Foucault was going to Stanford. Thank you, Marilyn. So, being a New Yorker, I said, well, why don't we just call him up and ask him whether you're right or I'm right, and we can talk about this some more, you know. And so I called him up, and he agreed to talk to us, and we picked him up at the hotel in San Francisco and drove him down to Stanford. And Dreyfus tape records absolutely everything he does in his entire life, because he claims not to have a memory, and he thinks he's a computer, or some kind of cyborg in any case. So that opened this discussion where we spent 8 hours that day talking to him. And I've written an article about this, which I go on in somewhat more detail. It's not published yet, but it will be. In which basically Foucault, like Bourdieu, like Dumont, had no one to talk to. This is very strong in France, that the boundaries of who you actually can talk to and confide in are extremely rigorously policed and very isolating them the higher you go. And Foucault was keenly suffering from this. So here are these two little Jewish guys, who neither of whom were too particularly interested in his work, and neither of whom were certainly disciples, and neither of whom particularly had any stakes in the matter, but thought he was confused about some things and needed to clarify some stuff. And and he just responded extraordinarily well, because it was just a gift for him to actually be able to engage in discussion without being so guarded. So as he said once, in Paris, if you say you're talking about the Enlightenment, the one thing you can be sure of is That's not what you're talking about. Whereas in Berkeley, and this is a little bit the trope of the, you know, California as the happy natives, people say they're talking about the Enlightenment, they're talking about the Enlightenment. So they're developed a very strong intellectual connection in which he really needed that, Foucault really needed this sort of exchange and with this kind of stake at that point. And then a previous, my first wife, I've only had two, and I became good friends with Foucault and Foucault's partner, Daniel Defer, and spent a year and a half in Paris at that point, in which we ate together and spent time together. And then Foucault was coming back to Berkeley regularly and intended to come back to Berkeley each year. Unfortunately, then he got ill and died very, very suddenly, very rapidly. And during the course of these discussions, the structuralism issue fell away, and this another range of way of putting together rigorous concept work with detailed empirical work began to be exciting to me. I mean, that's to me what I like about anthropology and why I'm an anthropologist and not a philosopher. But very few of any philosophers ever put the two together. So Heidegger, no, Wittgenstein, no, John Searle, no, etc. Foucault really, really exemplified, it seems to me, that the real turn that philosophic thinking in modernity, one way of taking that up in any case. But also, since what he was doing and what I was doing was never the same, and because he was a very complicated human being, it was also it was possible to work alongside him and also to be independent at the same time. So that became a tremendous turning point for me. And among other things, enabled me to turn the fact that I didn't want to go to Morocco. I was attempting to go to Vietnam, as again I mentioned briefly today. And during this period of time and with this these discussions with Foucault, I began to be able to think about a conceptual framework, which would be a kind of archaeological history of the present. And French Modern is sort of my example of this work. So I continue to think he's a very, very great thinker. But I also continue to think that what he did was what he did. It had its limits, and there are many other things to do that he didn't do. So much of the Foucault literature I find, I don't read, but what little of it I read, when my students tell me about, I find wrong, especially British literature, I might add. Governmentality literature, I think, is dreadfully wrong. And many, many things continue to be opened up by Foucault. So again, like McKeon, I had great influence, but not impossible for me, in any case, to be a disciple. And that's the position that I want. Foucault also wanted that, as McKeon said he wanted that, whether he did or not, I don't know. But Foucault certainly wanted people to govern themselves. And it was very hard to take that seriously because he was so overpowering and brilliant. Bourdieu wanted you to be part of his state. Foucault hated that, and hence that suited me. So I've continued with that as one of the things that I do, not the only thing. Is that helpful? Or is that
it enough? Is very helpful. I mean, just two very quick things,
because
one could have a whole. One is McKeon you didn't actually like very much. I mean, you admired him and so on, but did you like Foucault? Was he someone you could say whether you liked him or not? I mean, as a person, he was a homosexual, wasn't he? And
he was a very unhappy, deeply private man. He was an extremely kind man, in a way that many others weren't. He was very attentive to small human things. And hence he was always, at that level, was always comfortable being around him. He cooked for us and he... On the other hand, you always had a sense that he was somewhere else. He was also in this period, I'm writing this piece for Theory, Culture and Society, which I can send you. He was quasi-suicidal at this during these years. He was deeply in the process of changing his thought. His relationship with Danielle was not good. Was I close to him? I think probably not. And also, since I wasn't homosexual, and one of his great lines is, I love San Francisco because there are so many gays and I am a homosexual. But on the other hand, yes, I was deeply fond of him.
If you had to convince someone in about 2 minutes, like myself, who's a great skeptic about Foucault, why he's a great thinker, for at least for anthropologists, why he's important for anthropologists, how would you?
I think the two lines are, at some level, very simple and very complicated to explain. I think if you buy the argument that with Heidegger and Wittgenstein, traditional Western metaphysics was over, then philosophy, those people who wanted to continue to do philosophy or better, to lead a philosophic life, had to figure out a different form of leading that life. Richard Rorty tried and didn't know how to do it, because most philosophers can only do traditional philosophy, even though they know that that tradition is over. So Foucault is, on the one hand, figured out a different way of doing, I think, leading a philosophic life, which included, and this is the anthropological part, a Nietzschean, but also anthropological attention to detail, and in his case, historical, archaeological detail. But he spent his life not arguing concepts with people, but working through material. And his books are the idea that Foucault, there are no actors and all this stuff. You read these books, and including some of the lectures, later lectures, which are absolutely magnificent in my view, their engagement with detailed historical context, with options and constraints, with settings and milieu. And it's that combination of attention to detail and context combined with a passion for conceptual clarification and work, which seems to me unique. Dumont, you knew what his theory was, and he did wonderful things with it. Bourdieu, theory, examples. And this is, Foucault developed a very different relation between theory and examples. I don't think he had any theory. I know he didn't have any theory. So this is in the Cogniem tradition of concepts, experiments, and results, which then become problems. And I think that very few of the Foucault followers, if one judged Foucault by his followers, like many thinkers, it's fairly disastrous. But for me, this was a philosophic life, and in many ways a deep anthropological life, always engaged outward while thinking all the time. So that would be the short version. And hence, one would need to read those books, and particularly the lectures, the recent lectures are very helpful, as examples of experiences and experiments rather than theory or doctrine or epical diagnosis or the usual things that are said about Foucault, all of which I could argue at length are really wrong. No one listens to me, but my students listen.
They have to. Well, that's very interesting. I'll try again, maybe. Let's move on to your subsequent work. I mean, a lot of it has been on the borderline with science, and as you mentioned recently, molecular biology. How did you get interested in all that, and tell us about it?
French Modern took the category society and nominalized it. It showed that what was taken to be a universal, all human groups are society, or have a society, or can be analyzed as having a society, had a history to where the term emerged in the cholera epidemics of the 1830s, and then was involved in long, complicated elaborations in pragmatic and political contexts. The next set of projects was suggested by Canguilhem, and was to take the term life. George Canguilhem.
Oh yes, can you spell it for us?
Canguilhem.
Right.
The great French historian of science, and particularly the life sciences. Hmm. So the idea was to take life as the similar kind of concept, not history of ideas, but as a practice and as a knowledge production venue, and to look at that point at the emerging genomic sciences, which were clearly transforming the biological understanding of what life was, but to do it in detail in terms of where this knowledge was being produced, how it was being produced, and then to a lesser degree, how it was circulating. And that's what I've continued to do, although the shift now is from life to anthropos. So at the end of the game, I'm an anthropologist, and for me, that's a question of anthropos, which in Greek is the human thing, and logoi. And it's, as we've been, one way of characterizing what I've been saying is that anthropos is that being who lives through logoi, but many logoi, lives through logos, but through many logoi, and hence there's an essential...
Describe logoi, or logos as your...
Logos or logoi are...
the word, isn't it, logos?
It's a Greek word meaning both speech and truth. Mm. So these are truth claims. Mm. So we understand ourselves, not everybody to the same degree, obviously, but we understand ourselves as beings who say true things about ourselves and about the way we and others live. And that seems to me one form, at least, of what anthropology is. And currently, one of the main groupings of logoi, which tell us who we really are the biosciences. So I'm not interested in the truth claims per se of the biosciences, like Dawkins and others, but in the way that shapes us as human beings. So I'm an anthropologist of anthropos, as it were, and logoi, and that's currently what I'm involved in and interested in doing. And this leads to, I'm currently working in synthetic biology, and I'm interested in how synthetic biology and synthetic anthropos are converging, or might converge, or could come together in various arts and techniques, which are going to form, like YouTube and the rest, which are going to a degree, form how we understand ourselves and who we are, and how we will shape the environments that we work in, etc., etc. So there is a kind of long trajectory there, which at greater length has some coherence to it, I believe. And again, I think Foucault provided tools to do history of the present, but didn't, of course, wasn't an anthropologist and wasn't actually ever primarily interested, and certainly never wrote about contemporary reality per se. He always stopped, usually around 1840. So the question for the rest of us then is, well, what is anthropology if it's not that? And there are many answers to that. But I'm trying to articulate one version of what that might look like, with again this combination of reflective and conceptual work with a deep commitment to empirical, being close to the practices going on in the world, not just in discourse. And that's, to me, the anthropological ethic is to be out rather than in, as it were.
Two ways of drawing that out a little bit. One is, how does this differ from science and technology studies, from the work of Bruno Latour and John Law and laboratory science work?
Right. It's both very close and very far. Bruno has substituted one theory for another theory. So he and Bourdieu hated each other. And they hated each other because, among other reasons, Bourdieu thought the universal category was society. Latour has argued thousands of pages, no, it's actor network. There is no society, a society is an actor network. But he has a single universal answer for everything that's going on. He does it brilliantly. And I mean that in a genuine sense. It's also, to me, totally boring, because after you know the moves, nothing new really emerges on the one hand. And this is related to a degree to his mode of production, as it were. Bruno worked in the École des Mines for many, many, many years. Very theoretical. Then they had contracts where they would do short-term field work and write a report. So he developed a methodology which works extremely well for that. So that's one side, that it's too pat. It's a theory. It's not concept work. John Law I have respect for, but he and a lot of other people in science studies have an ironic attitude towards science, which I don't share. I think it's an unearned and false distance. And I think we're in the most exciting period of understanding living beings since Darwin, and that I'm not looking to be distant from it. I'm looking to understand it, to protect and promote enlightenment, which is under attack in the United States and in many other places, but then also to think about it in a second-order way. So I think many of the science and technology studies, much of that work is interesting, but I don't share the project. And if that crew, the person I'm closest to is Chapin, and we've had very good...
Stephen Chapin.
We've had very good discussions, and his new book, which came out a month or two ago, is somewhat of a product of our discussions and his...
What is that book called?
It's, I don't know the title, since I was involved in so many versions of it, but it's basically biotechnology and science as a vocation in the 20th century, and a kind of detailed study of the changing position of the scientist and the moral credibility of the scientist, and how that shifted in the 20th century. An excellent piece of work.
The second question is, how do you practice this kind of anthropology? What do you do? I notice you've set up a number of centers and institutes and so on. It's always struck me as difficult to imagine what is. I have friends like Georgina Bourne and others who've worked in laboratories, but it does seem very difficult. It's very different from the traditional anthropological field work.
Right.
But how do you do your studies? Do you talk to them? Do you live with them? Do you?
Both. Two framing ideas. George Marcus and I have been talking for some time, and we actually have a book that's coming out any day now of conversations around the fact that there's a space between laboratory say biological laboratories and architectural or artistic design studios, in which collective criticism of individual projects has been articulated and developed, which allows something like ferocious criticism that's depersonalized and enables collective work to go forward. I think this is one of the great inventions of the biosciences, and Chaikin's social history of truth is some of it, but there's actually not a history of lab meetings, for instance, which I think are an extremely important technology, or a history of the critique studios.
You know June Goodfield's, I think it's June Goodfield, who wrote about development of science. I'll tell you about it afterwards.
But that would be wonderful.
It's an account of how observation over a couple of years of a scientific experiment, but anyway, it sort of talked about the lab meetings a bit, but not much, yeah.
Very important. So somewhere in between, it seems to me, the human sciences, and anthropology in particular, it seems should be trying to articulate ways that we can both work on individual projects, but work critically in a collaborative sense and develop venues in which a certain form of criticism, which would enrich multiple projects, could go on without it becoming the Bourdieu or the Gertz sort of, if you don't agree with me on everything, you're out, or what have you. Given that careers are still individual, and given that careers in the human sciences are still, as opposed to the biosciences, are still based on individual publications, this is a dilemma, although I think the days of that are not going to continue very much longer as the monograph disappears, as the publication, etc. So I'm interested in trying to develop venues in which a form of collaborative work can go on. And it has the self-formative and pedagogical dimension that I've talked about on the one hand, but also the kind of objects and projects that we're interested in. First of all, their temporality and their complexity is such that the more traditional anthropological methods simply need to be modified if we're going to continue as a relevant discipline in the 21st century. So broadly speaking, that's what I'm attempting to do. So of course there's some observation and personal contact, but I don't do any more laboratory studies. And now I'm actually a principal investigator in the Synthetic Biology Center, so I have a different relationship there as well.
I think we're coming towards the end, but I'm trying to think. We talked about religion. We haven't talked much about politics, but you've alluded to the fact that you think of yourself as a non-Marxist leftish sort of person.
Right.
Are there other things which you would like me to have asked you about or talked about that I've missed out?
I think it's extremely important to defend learning. Sounds like a strange thing to say, but I think that, and in many ways, of course, in the United States, there are pressures, vastly anti-intellectual currents and pressures. But in the UK as well, as Marilyn Strathern and others have shown us, the pressures of audit society, of instrumental, immediate instrumental implications of one's work, relevance, and the rest, I think need to be resisted. And so one of my politics, I have a kind of politics of truth, which is attempting to also to convince some of the scientists that they're much more vulnerable than they think they are. And that if the university is going to reinvent itself as a place of somewhat disinterested learning, which I think is absolutely precious, that we need to do it, to defend this in a more articulate fashion. I think if you look around for defenses of science, you'll find very few of them. So I was at a meeting with Phil Campbell, the editor of Nature, and a number of other people, and people get up and give eloquent speeches about here's science and here's society and we have the truth and then there's the stuff outside. It's not true. And so if I have a cause, it's kind of some kind of cosmopolitan enlightened curiosity and defensive venues which will make that flourish in the 21st century.
Do you feel Berkeley is a place that does it?
I feel Berkeley is a great research university. The University of Chicago was a great university. Berkeley is not a great university. Pedagogy and teaching and learning are not central at Berkeley. One can do it, but for instance, I have to fight for a classroom if I want to teach for 3 hours instead of 2 hours. And there's no overall curriculum, and hence there's no deep Wissenschaft. So no, I don't think Berkeley's a great university.
You don't mind what's going on to YouTube?
I say this all the time.
Okay. Well, anything else? So that's very important. But
thank you for doing this.
Thank you very much for a fascinating talk.